From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a roundup of last night's municipal elections, including the preliminary in the Boston mayoral race.
We use that growth to fund more of our schools, more job training in our neighborhoods, more resources to our parks and playgrounds and libraries than they've ever seen before in this city's history.
We have over a 30% increase in murders. We have a huge increase in shootings. And in my administration, we will make sure that a life on Blue Hill Avenue,
come on,
will mean the same as a life on Commonwealth Avenue. Yeah!
Also today, President Trump unveils his new tax plan. We'll have live coverage of his speech.
I am not going to negotiate. That's the number I wanted to get to. I wanted to start at 15 to get there. We've really had to start there because of the complexity of the numbers. But 20 is a perfect number.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Donald Trump is expected to unveil his administration's proposal for what could be the most sweeping changes to the federal tax code in decades. The president's expected to speak about it in Indiana at roughly 3:20, and we will bring you that speech, followed by analysis as soon as it begins. But while we wait, let's take a look at politics closer to home, because last night, several key municipal elections and preliminaries took place here in Massachusetts. First, in Boston, two candidates emerged in the Boston preliminary, incumbent Mayor Marty Walsh and City Councilor Tito Jackson. That's, of course, for the Boston mayoral race. And here now with more is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Hello, Anthony.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, before we dig into the actual numbers of the Walsh Jackson race here, I want to talk about the turnout. Only 14% of Boston voters turned out. What does that say about the race?
Yeah, it's a low number. And I guess it says a couple of things. You could argue that it bodes well for Mayor Marty Walsh, the incumbent, because for many people in Boston, things are going pretty well. There isn't a fiscal, political, or corruption crisis that might have driven more people to the polls. The economy is relatively strong, even if it's leaving quite a few people behind. We'll get into that in a bit. But these are arguably pretty good times in Boston, so there isn't that sense that would, that sense of urgency to get people out who want to shake things up. Another reason, and you'll hear this from the supporters of Tito Jackson, they're frustrated that they didn't have a chance to get a one-on-one debate with Marty Walsh and Tito Jackson. They also say that Boston did too little to promote this election in an effort to help the incumbent. Whether that's true or not is difficult to determine. But put all that together, and you ended up with a pretty low voter turnout.
Yeah, that 14% of total voters. Well, of that 14%, the mayor, the incumbent, got 63% of the vote. Jackson, 29%. So what do you make of the results?
Well, clearly a good night for Marty Walsh. More than twice as many folks voted for him than Jackson. He even beat Tito Jackson in the District 7 neighborhoods that Jackson represents. Mm. But, you know, give credit to Tito Jackson. He's a serious candidate. He becomes the first black mayoral candidate in more than 30 years since Mel King ran against Ray Flynn. He's relying on an army of volunteers, a lot less money to wage a populist campaign, and he's raising some pretty important issues that should make for a pretty lively and good debate in the coming weeks.
Okay, so what are then the key issues that we're likely to hear debate over between Walsh and Jackson?
Well, for Mayor Walsh, he said yesterday, "Judge me on my record," and he'll make a case that Boston is a city on the rise under his stewardship. He takes credit for adding jobs, more housing, fewer homeless people, a AAA bond rating, and a booming business economy. Here's a bit of what he said last night in Dorchester after the polls closed.
We have new companies like GE and Lego and Reebok coming into our city and taking our economy to the next level. We use that growth to fund more of our schools, more job training in our neighborhoods, more resources to our parks and playgrounds and libraries than they've ever seen before in this city's history.
Mm. Yeah, so Meghna, it's going to be, look at my record, look what I've done, give me another 4 years. Tito Jackson has another view. If Mayor Walsh says this is a glass more than half full, Tito Jackson says this is a glass that's half empty. A booming economy that's helping some, but leaves too many people behind. We have one of the highest rate of income disparity and wealth disparity in the nation here in Boston. So he's waging very much a populist campaign on behalf of poor and working Bostonians being squeezed out of neighborhoods because of rising rents. The kinds of things that he's pushing for: a $15 minimum wage, expand affordable housing, spend more on education, and a big theme, democratize City Hall. Among the things he wants to do is abolish the Boston Planning and Development Agency, which he says is undemocratic, and make the Boston School Board an elected school board. Mm. And here's a bit of what we heard from Tito Jackson last night.
We have over 30% increase in murders. We have a huge increase in shootings. And in my administration, we will make sure that a life on Blue Hill Avenue,
come on,
will mean the same as a life on Commonwealth Avenue.
Yeah! Yeah!
And Anthony, if there's one thing that's for sure in this race, both of these men have very interesting backgrounds.
Yeah, they really do. I think most of a lot of Bostonians know something about the mayor already. Union guy, cancer survivor, recovering alcoholic, speaks very passionately and eloquently to the recovering community. Tito Jackson, a really interesting personal story. His birth mother was a 13-year-old girl who was sexually assaulted, and then he was adopted by Rosa and Herb Jackson, who were two Boston activists, and really grew up taking on the sort of activist energy of his families, and ended up at UNH on a very white campus where he reestablished the Black Student Union and really began kind of political advocacy there. Now he's bringing a lot of issues to the fore here in Boston.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, as you mentioned a bit earlier, Anthony, Mayor Walsh and Councillor Jackson did not engage publicly in a face-to-face debate before the preliminary. I mean, there were four folks total before this preliminary, but these two were the main candidates,
right,
even before yesterday. They didn't engage in a face-to-face debate. We had a couple of forums back-to-back, but now that the two are the final candidates for the mayoral race, what do you expect between now and November?
Well, it's going to be interesting to watch. I mean, you've got to give the advantage to the incumbent. I mean, beating an incumbent mayor in Boston is historically difficult.
Yeah, well, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, there are the numbers that are just insane over the course of 150 years, how rarely this happens. Walsh has millions in his campaign account. He's got the support of the Democratic establishment. And he also remains very popular. I mean, that has to be stressed. But Jackson is bringing some important issues to the table, a great opportunity, I think, for an important citywide debate, particularly about the huge wealth disparity in the city. For example, you know, Jackson thinks it's a mistake to lure big companies like GE to Boston because they don't spread the wealth to working folks, but they do cause the rents to go up. And this is a real debate, not only in this city, but across the country, about how best to respond to growing economic disparity. So I think there will be a debate about that, about how successfully Boston is dealing with the crime issue. Overall, things are pretty good in this city, especially mm-hmm. compared to others. But as Jackson points out, not so great if you live in one of the handful of neighborhoods where the majority of shootings and killings are taking place. There's a big argument about public schools. If you think they're improving, then give Walsh credit. If you're frustrated by a stubborn achievement gap, Tito Jackson probably has something to say about that. It should be a lot of really interesting conversations.
Absolutely. We can say with confidence, hopefully, that the city will get the exact kind of political and policy debate between these two that it deserves.
Absolutely.
Between now and election night. WBR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks bringing us up to speed on last night's preliminary in the Boston mayoral campaign. Thank you so much, Anthony.
My pleasure, Magna.
All right. Well, let's now turn to Framingham, where voters there for the first time voted in a preliminary election for mayor because Framingham is now officially a city in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Metro West Daily reporter Jim Hudadin hosts the Making a City podcast, which focuses on the Framingham election. And he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Magna. Nice to be with you.
It's great to have you. So first of all, give us a little insight into last night's results. What happened in Framingham?
The big story out of last night's preliminary was the impressive victory from a relative newcomer to politics in Framingham, Yvonne Spicer. She works at the Museum of Science in Boston. She was, for many years, a school teacher in Framingham. She's served on town meeting, which is an elected position in the town, but hasn't really had a major role in politics. And she stepped in for a seven-way race for mayor and managed to come out with more than half the vote, running against John Stefanini, a former state representative and former town selectman who is very well known here and had a lot of support. So I think a lot of people were surprised by her margin of victory last night.
It does sound surprising. A seven-way race, you said, and Spicer came away with, what, 54% of the vote?
Yeah, she came away with the newest totals out this morning are 5,967 votes to Stefanini's 3,184. So it was almost 2-to-1 support and 2-to-1 in many precincts. Almost across town, she captured the vote. So it is a long road ahead for John Stefanini if he's going to manage to pull this out on November 7th.
Huh. Now, have you had a chance to talk to folks who voted for either Spicer or Stefanini and why they were drawn to each candidate?
I spent some time at the polls yesterday asking people what was on their minds. One thing you hear a lot about in Framingham is development and the threat of overdevelopment as the land in Framingham and Metro West kind of becomes more valuable with a scarcity of developable land in the area, and people are looking to build housing and address the housing shortage around here. So there are proposals to put apartments in a lot of places in Framingham and really increase the housing stock. Some people think that's a great thing. Some people are worried about what it's going to do to traffic, what it's going to do to the population of school-aged children. And so there's a lot of focus on that and a lot of attention on what the candidates are going to do to make sure development goes in the right place. There's also been, this is an election that's been about policy issues, but also about the character of the candidates, and there have been a few events that happened along the way that called into question the character of the candidates, and I think that really has been also on the minds of voters.
Okay, so you can't say that without me saying, events? What events?
So back in May, this is right after the community decided to become a city, took its passed a referendum in April to pass a new city charter. Early days of the campaign, there was this moment where Stefanini was video recorded removing some campaign materials that had been set up by an Yvonne Spicer supporter in a lobby at the library. We put in a public records request to the police department and got a copy of that videotape, and it has been viewed many, many times, and I think that really left an impression with people. Stefanini has apologized. He said that he thought that these materials had been left out in the lobby in violation of a town policy on campaigning, and had the best intentions doing it. But I think a lot of people really did have that in mind, and people I spoke to when they went to the polls yesterday and felt like that was an action that spoke to Stefanini's character.
Mm. And sorry, Jim, go ahead.
And there have also been, on the other side, questions about Yvonne Spicer's voting record. There was this kind of mysterious robocall that went out Monday evening right before, 24 hours before people were going to vote, that pointed out that she has not participated in a number of local elections over the last decade. And so I think people also had questions about that, too.
Oh, interesting. Now, Jim, obviously this is the first time that Framingham voters have had a chance to cast any kind of ballot in a mayoral election, because the Framingham narrowly voted in April to change to city governance. So, I mean, look, I think all elections are consequential, but this one's particularly special in Framingham. So what are the biggest challenges ahead?
Well, This is a special moment for the community, and in addition to electing people who they think are smart and capable, people are looking for candidates who will bridge this gap from a town meeting system to a new city structure, which has fewer people in elected positions, fewer people with more authority and political power over what happens. So they're looking for people that are cognizant of the need to make that transition smooth. And it's important to remember that when the city charter passed in April, this was not an overwhelming mandate to do this.
Right.
The community has kind of, for a century, been debating whether it should stay a town or become a city, and the city charter only passed by 108 votes. So there's some bitterness around that, and I think a lot of the people who were pro-town and didn't want to see the city structure come in have moved into the Yvonne Spicer camp because they do see her as more of an outsider candidate who is going to make sure that things like public participation are still, still thrives when the new city council takes office.
That's interesting. And thanks for reminding us, Jim, about how close the vote was about changing Framingham's municipal governance. Because to that point, I understand that turnout yesterday was, 27-ish percent, which is roughly the same of what it was when Framingham took a vote to change to city governance. I mean, it seems kind of surprising to me. One would think that it might be higher if it's the first time that they have a crack at taking a pick for mayor.
Yeah, so it was 27.5%, and, you can kind of look at this both ways. I mean, in some ways, I think the people of Framingham should be proud that they beat the pants off of voters in Boston in yesterday's election.
You should take pride in that.
Yeah, and historically, for local elections in Framingham, that the community really has struggled to break above single digits for people coming out to vote. So that even that 28% in April was a maybe 20-year high for voter participation in Framingham. So some people might look at yesterday's vote and say, that's a good sign that we had 27. Perhaps you would have even more coming out for the general election when, there are fewer people to think about and kind of a firmer set of decisions to make. But it is kind of an important test of this experiment the community is doing with a new city government, because one of the selling points from the people who were in favor of this is that it would increase local participation in elections. So this is kind of the first test of that to see whether, in fact, that's the case.
Well, Jim Hudadin is a reporter for Metro West Daily News. He also hosts the Making a City podcast. Jim, it was a real pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And all elections are local. All politics are local, especially when it comes to local politics. So let's move now to Lawrence. It's a second face-off there between two mayors. And to give us insight on what exactly I'm talking about, we're joined by Keith Eddings, a reporter with the Lawrence Eagle Tribune. Keith, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So lots of folks will recognize the name William Lantigua, former mayor of Lawrence, former state rep. He's back now, challenging incumbent Mayor Daniel Rivera. So what happened?
The incumbent, Dan Rivera, beat Lantigua 4 years ago by just 81 votes. Lantigua tried a couple of comebacks since then, including to get his old statehouse seat back, and that failed. So this was actually his fourth attempt, or third attempt at a comeback, and he may have pulled this one off. He came in with he came in second last night. I wouldn't call it a tight second, but I call it an impressive second. The mayor got about 4,900 votes, and Lantigua got about 3,800, and all the other six candidates were pretty much left in the dust. So Lantigua's back, and it's going to make this a fun race to cover.
Fun because Mr. Lantigua has a controversial background, to say the least. Remind us of that.
He's got a style in government and politics that distinguished himself, I think, is the way we could put it, from what most people expect. He's very much, sort of the Latin American style, charismatic populist here in Lawrence, and it's to some extent effective because it's a very Latin city. It's 80% Latino, I think, most from the Dominican Republic. And as a matter of fact, the mayor was born in Tenares in the Dominican Republic, or close to Tenares. And after his last loss for the statehouse seat, he went home to Dominican Republic and disappeared basically for 2 years, and then came back. So he's got a distinct style. He had some issues with corruption in his last administration. His chief of staff went to jail. The officer he promoted to deputy police chief was accused of corruption and tried, found not guilty. He had some other issues in his administration as well with other people who were also charged but acquitted.
So, Keith, I have to say, that's a very civil way of putting it. Issues with corruption. Is that how it's described in Lawrence?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, I mean, I'm seeing, as you said, the issues that he had with members of his staff, also being investigated, having been investigated for campaign finance violations.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Things like that. I was just ribbing you for being polite to Mr. Lantigua in your description.
He was actually barred. The Office of Campaign and Political Finance, which enforces campaign finance law, actually barred him from the ballot for a while because of his failure to file of campaign financial disclosure forms. He's been fined a lot of money by that agency, and I think he currently has a debt of several thousand dollars. So it's all of that is, as I said, his populist style, his the corruption issues that his administration faced. He was several times called before a grand jury 4 years ago. He was never indicted, but a couple of his aides were, three were, and one went to jail. Those are the issues that the incumbent mayor, Dan Rivera, doesn't have those issues.
Yeah. This is the word issues. Millennials throw it around a lot. I just wanted to get specific on what those issues were. Now, Keith, finally, what kind of a campaign do you expect between the two men, between Mayor Rivera and William Lantigua in the next month and a half?
Well, I'm writing a story about that for tomorrow, and I can I don't mind reading you a quote from the mayor right now.
Yeah.
The mayor said that that William Lantigua is going to be issue number one in this race, and so I think we can expect that each candidate is going to try to make the other issue number one, the other's management style. Whether the real issues facing this city, and this is a very poor city, so there are issues of many, crime, opioids, state control of city spending. And also state control of the schools. Your listeners may be aware that Lawrence was the first school system in the state that was entirely seized by the state.
Mm-hmm.
And the state also has a fiscal overseer that controls spending at City Hall, and that's been going on for 7 or 8 years. And there's whether or not that's going to get any much attention, we'll see. Housing is a big issue. The mills are filling up in the city, but the mayor feels that the mills should be, when they reopen, they should reopen for business and industry, not for housing.
Oh, interesting.
And, of course, economic development is a big issue. We just lost Polar Tech.
Wow, yeah. So a lot at stake in this election in Lawrence. Keith Eddings, reporter with the Lawrence Eagle Tribune, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was great being here. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. So that was a terrific roundup of several important municipal elections or races voting that happened yesterday. We are still waiting for President Donald Trump in Indiana to speak about his new tax plan for the federal tax code. We're going to take a quick break and come back, and we will turn to the president as soon as he begins speaking. So stick with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are awaiting President Donald Trump. He's scheduled to be in Indianapolis and expected to begin a major speech outlining his administration's plans to overhaul the federal tax code. Now, we will bring you that speech, or the president's speech, as soon as he begins. But a version or some top lines from that plan were released a little earlier today, and they include a cut at the top individual income tax rate down from 39.6% to 35%, a slash in the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%, and a creation of a new 25% rate for a so-called pass-through taxes where businesses are currently taxed at the individual rate. So let's get some clarification on what the potential implications of this plan may be, the lines of it that we know about. And joining us to do so is Evan Horowitz. He is the Quick Study columnist for the Boston Globe. Evan, day two of talking taxes with you. I love this.
I'm really excited to be back.
It's good to have you.
Yeah.
Also with us is Noah Berger. He's president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center. It's great to have you back, Noah, as
great
well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Okay, so we have a several-page outline that was released a little earlier today by Republicans and the administration. What's your first reactions to the proposals that we're seeing for overhauling the federal tax code, Noah?
No. The proposals have a lot in common with what we've heard the president talk about before and what we've heard the Republicans in Congress talk about. It's a series of cuts that primarily benefit higher-income individual taxpayers, but even more so corporate taxpayers. And the president has tried to make an argument that when you cut taxes for corporations, somehow that's a way to benefit working people. The serious analysis of those tax cuts shows that overwhelmingly, the benefits of corporate tax cuts go back to the stockholders of corporations, that about 70% of the benefits of those corporate tax cuts go to the highest income 20% of the population. So in a time when I think most people think our problem is that too many of the gains of our economic success are going to our very highest income residents, this is a tax cut that may skew that even worse.
But of course, I mean, the counter argument has constantly been that reduction in taxes for corporation or the highest earners is an engine for job creation, Evan.
Well, the Federal Reserve thinks we are running the economy as hot as we can run it. They're trying to slow it down because it's running too hot. Further job creation can't happen unless the Fed allows it to happen, it's not going to happen. The thing that really strikes me about the plan, though, just to step back, is it's not a plan. It's barely a plan. It's half of a skeleton of a plan with details they keep promising to fill in and never get filled in. For instance, how are we going to pay for $5 trillion in tax cuts over 10 years? Oh, we're going to cut things. What things? We haven't decided yet.
Well, the framework does attempt to simplify the tax code, as I'm seeing here. And actually, we'll let the president speak for himself because he's beginning a speech in Indianapolis.
Thank you very much. You just want massive tax cuts. That's what you want. That's the only reason you're going so wild. But it's wonderful to be back in the great state of Indiana. What a place. I want to thank Senator Todd Young, Senator Joe Donnelly, Representative Jackie Walorski, Representative Susan Brooks, and Representative Mike Messer for joining us today. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it. I also want to thank members of my economic team, Secretary Steven Mnuchin, and Director Gary Cohn for joining us as well. We appreciate it. Let me begin by saying that our hearts and prayers go out to the people of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, who are suffering in the wake of yet another catastrophic hurricane. I mean, their island was virtually destroyed. Federal agencies are working closely with local partners to help these communities get back on their feet as soon as possible. Texas, Florida, Louisiana are doing great, and the recovery process is happening very, very quickly. I will be going down to Puerto Rico next week to get an on-the-ground briefing about the disaster recovery and to see all of our great first responders and to meet a lot of the people who are so affected by these storms. We are with you now, I tell them, and we will be there every step of the way until this job is done. It is truly catastrophic what happened in Puerto Rico. And massive amounts of water, food, and supplies, by the way, are being delivered on an hourly basis. It's something that nobody's ever seen before from this country, I can tell you that. And I'm very proud of all of the folks that have worked so hard in FEMA, all of our first responders, all of our police that have gone to the island because their police force has been so badly affected. And many of their policemen, in fact, most of the police people, have lost their homes, and it's been a tough go, but we're going to get it back. Before we go on to discuss the largest tax cut in our country's history, I also want to provide a brief update on health care. We have the votes on Graham Cassidy, but with the rules of reconciliation, we're up against a deadline of Friday, 2 days. That's just 2 days. And yes vote, Senator. We have a wonderful senator, great, great senator, who is a yes vote, but he's home recovering from a pretty tough situation. And with so many great features, including all of the block granting, the money to the states, et cetera, our health care plan is really going to be something excellent. It's going to be better managed for the people that it serves. Having local health care representatives is far better than having health care managed from Washington, D.C. Not even a contest. And many, many governors, as you also see, have agreed with us and approved it and really look forward to running it properly. But again, because the reconciliation window is about to close, we have to wait a few months until it reopens before we take a vote. So we're getting all of the good signs from Alaska and the others to repeal and replace Obamacare. And I was hoping this would be put on my desk right after we won the election and I'd come in and sign, but it didn't work that way. There are a couple of people that I won't say anything. But early next year, when reconciliation kicks back in any event, long before the November election, we're going to have a vote and we're going to be able to get that through. And I think we'll actually get it through very easily, and the time makes it easier. But speaking of reconciliation, the Republican Senate needs to get rid of the filibuster rule, which is blocking so many great legislative reforms the American people badly want and deserve. By the way, the Democrats, if they had the opportunity, which hopefully they won't for many, many years, they would get rid of it on day one. And most of you know exactly what I'm talking about. We're here today in Indiana to announce our framework to deliver historic tax relief to the American people. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity, and I guess it's probably something I could say that I'm very good at. I've been waiting for this for a long time. We're going to cut taxes for the middle class, make the tax code simpler and more fair for everyday Americans, and we are going to bring back the jobs and wealth that have left our country, and most people thought left our country for good. We want tax reform that is pro-growth, pro-jobs, pro-worker, pro-family, and yes, tax reform that is pro-American. It's time to take care of our people, to rebuild our nation, and to fight for our great American workers. Indiana is a tremendous example of the prosperity that is unleashed when we cut taxes and set free the dreams of our citizens. This state has claimed a powerful competitive edge built on low taxes and less regulation. And are we cutting regulation? And businesses all across the country have taken notice. In recent years, Indiana has welcomed dozens of companies fleeing high taxes and high tax states. Thousands of new jobs and massive capital investment have followed, meaning a better quality of life for the people of Indiana. All of this is possible because the people of this state have made a decision. They chose to make Indiana competitive again. They chose, and their choice was so important. It included electing a governor who you may have heard of, who signed the largest income tax cut in the state's history, our very, very terrific person and terrific Vice President, Mike Pence. It's time for Washington to learn from the wisdom of Indiana. We need Washington to promote American jobs instead of obstructing them. That is what I've been working to achieve every day since I took office. That is what I talked about on the campaign trail. Already, we're seeing the results of an economic policy that finally puts America first. Unemployment is at a 16-year low. Unemployment for African Americans is near its lowest point since the turn of the millennium. It's really a fantastic thing to see. Wages are rising. Optimism among manufacturers has reached all-time highs. GDP growth last quarter reached 3%, way ahead of schedule. Nobody thought that was going to happen for a long time. And this quarter, I believe, would have been better, but the hurricanes will have an impact. But other than that, it would have been, in my opinion, even better. Your government is working for you once again, not for the donors, not the special interests, but the hardworking, tax-paying citizens of our country. America is back on the right track, and I see so many red hats. Make America great again. That's what we're doing. Make America great again. But our country and our economy cannot take off like they should unless we dramatically reform America's outdated, complex, and extremely burdensome tax code. It's a relic. Got to change it. We have to compete with other countries. The current tax system is a colossal barrier standing in the way of America's economic comeback, because it can be far greater than it's ever been. But we're going to remove that barrier to create the tax system that our people finally, and want and deserve. For several months, my administration has been working closely with Congress to develop a framework for tax reform. Over the next few months, the House and Senate will build on this framework and produce legislation that will deliver more jobs, higher pay, and lower taxes for middle-class families, for the working man and woman, and for businesses of all sizes. I look forward, thank you. I look forward to working with Congress to deliver these historic tax cuts and reforms to the American people. These tax cuts are significant. There's never been tax cuts like what we're talking about. Our framework is based on four key ideas. First, we will cut taxes for the everyday, hardworking Americans, the people that work so long, so hard, and they've been forgotten. But they're not forgotten anymore. I think we proved that on November 8th. Under this framework, the first $12,000 of income earned by a single individual will be tax-free. And a married couple won't pay a dime in taxes on their first $24,000 of income. So a married couple up to $24,000 can spend their money on their family, on their children, on what they have to do. So much better. In other words, more income for more people will be taxed at a rate of zero. At this 0% rate, taxable income will be subject to just three tax rates of 12%, 25%, and 35%. Jonathan Blanton and his wife, Jamie, from Greentown, are here with us today. Where are they? Oh, hello, Jonathan. How are you? Jonathan does industrial janitorial work, and Jamie works at an auto company. Together, they're raising four beautiful children, and last year they earned less than $90,000. Under our tax plan, they would have saved more than $1,000 and could be substantially more, and that's just on federal taxes. So they would have saved at least $1,000. Middle-income families will save even more money with an increased child tax credit for children under the age of 17, which so many families have been calling for. We will eliminate the marriage penalty in the existing credit and expand eligibility to include even more middle-income families. Greatly expanded. We're also expanding the child tax credit because we believe the most important investment our country can make is in our children. And this is just one more critical way that we're targeting relief to working families. In addition, under our framework, those caring for the elderly loved, and we love these people, but we're caring and we take such care of the elderly and other adult dependents will receive financial relief in the form of a $500 tax credit. We're doing everything we can to reduce the tax burden on you and your family. By eliminating tax breaks and loopholes, we will ensure that the benefits are focused on the middle class, the working men and women, not the highest income earners. Our framework includes our explicit commitment that tax reform will protect low-income and middle-income households, not the wealthy and well-connected. They can call me all they want. It's not going to help. I'm doing the right thing, and it's not good for me, believe me. But what is good for me, not only as president and legacy, what is good for me is if everything takes off like a rocket ship, like it should have for 20 years. That's good for me. That's good for everyone. And that's what I think is going to happen. And a lot of very wealthy people feel the same way, believe me. In fact, we are eliminating most itemized deductions that primarily benefit the wealthiest taxpayers. We have also given Congress the flexibility to add an additional top rate on the very highest income earners to provide even more tax relief for working people. Second, our framework will make the tax code simple, fair, and easy to understand. Finally, Americans waste money. Americans waste so much money, billions and billions of dollars, and many hours each year to comply with our ridiculously complex tax code. More than 90% of Americans use assistance to prepare their taxes. Under our framework, the vast majority of families will be able to file their taxes on a single sheet of paper. We are also repealing the alternative minimum tax, or AMT. About time. The AMT is actually a shadow tax system that requires many people to calculate their taxes two different ways and pay the higher of the two amounts. You're all familiar with it. Under our framework, the AMT will make even less sense because we are repealing many of the special interest tax breaks that it was designed to deal with. We are making our taxes simple again. We are simplifying our tax system. To protect millions of small businesses and the American farmer, we are finally ending the crushing, the horrible, the unfair estate tax, or as it is often referred to, the death tax. That means, especially for all of you with small businesses that are really tremendous businesses, you'll be able to leave them to your family, and your family won't have to run out and do a fire sale to try and get the money to pay the tax, lose the business, ends up going out of business. All of those jobs are lost. The farmers in particular are affected. They have wonderful farms, but they can't pay the tax. So they have to sell the farm. The people that buy it don't run it with love. They can't run it the same way. And it goes out. So that death tax is a disaster for this country and a disaster for so many small businesses and farmers, and we're getting rid of it. Now, if you don't like your family, it won't matter. Okay? But for those that love your family, it matters a lot. With us today is Kip Thom, a family farmer from Leesburg. Where's Kip? Good, Kip. Hi, Kip. Who fears that his family's farming heritage, it's been a long time. How long, Kip? 187 years. That's peanuts, Kip. Wow, that's a long time. But that great heritage could come to an end because of the death tax or the estate tax, and could make it impossible for him to pass that legacy to his wonderful family. We're not going to let that happen. We are not going to allow the death tax to steal away the American dream from these great, great families, many of which are in this room today. We will protect our farmers, our ranchers, and our small businesses, and we will make taxes simple, easy, and fair for all Americans. Okay? Third, we will cut taxes on American businesses to restore our competitive edge and create more jobs and higher wages for American workers. In Indiana, you have seen firsthand that cutting taxes on businesses makes your state more competitive and leads to more jobs and higher paychecks for your workers. Now, we want to do the same thing for America, making our country more competitive with other nations. And in many cases, those other nations are taking advantage of us in so many ways. They say they're friends, and perhaps they are. But believe me, I am renegotiating our trade deals, including NAFTA, including many other trade deals. And through regulation, all you have to do is look at the massive pipelines, Dakota Access. You take a look, 48,000 jobs immediately approved. So we're letting that happen. But in terms of the tax and the tax strategy that Ronald Reagan used to create an economic boom in the 1980s, when our economy took off, the middle class thrived, and the family income of all families was increasing more and more, and it was a beautiful sight to behold. Since then, other nations have adopted, unfortunately, our playbook and ran it even better than we did. And I shouldn't say even better, because we didn't run it well at all, and we let other nations come in and take advantage of us and take our jobs away and take our businesses out. And we're stopping that, and you see it right here, what we've done. Today, our total business tax rate is 60% higher than our average foreign competitor in the developed world. That's not good. We have surrendered our competitive edge to other countries, but we're not surrendering anymore. We're not surrendering anymore. Under our framework, we will dramatically cut the business tax rate so that American companies and American workers can beat our foreign competitors and start winning again. We will reduce the corporate tax rate to no higher than 20%. That's way down from 35 and 39, which is substantially below the average of other industrialized nations. This is a revolutionary change, and the biggest winners will be the everyday American workers as jobs start pouring into our country, as companies start competing for American labor, and as wages start going up at levels that you haven't seen in many years. When our companies move to other countries, it's our loyal American workers who get hurt. And when companies stay in America and come to America, it's our wonderful workers who reap the rewards. And I just left the United Nations last week, and I was told by one of the most powerful leaders of the world that they are going to be announcing in the not-too-distant future 5 major factories in the United States between increasing and new 5. You'll be hearing about that very soon. And I said, thank you very much. And he said, you know what? It's starting to happen in the United States. It's starting to happen. So I just wanted to let you know that. I promised I wouldn't say who. I'll keep my word, okay? Unless you force me. Members of both parties, it happens to be in the automobile industry, that's a good industry. Members of both parties should agree that we need a tax code that keeps jobs in our country and brings jobs back to our country. And for the millions of small businesses and farms that file their taxes as sole proprietors, S corporations or partnerships, we will cap the tax rate they pay at 25%, much lower. Big difference. This will be the lowest top marginal income tax rate for small and mid-sized businesses in this country in more than 80 years. To give businesses even more reason to boost their investment in America, for the next 5 years, our framework will allow to fully write off, listen to this, the cost of equipment in the year they buy it. That is big.
You're listening to live coverage of President Donald Trump's speech in Indianapolis, Indiana, outlining his new framework for a massive overhaul of the federal tax code.
Period of time. Now, that's called incentive. That's called incentive. This will be tremendously important to help American businesses afford the heavy industrial machinery and other capital investments they need to grow big and grow strong. Joining us today is John Gannon, the owner of a custom wood fencing and deck construction company in Indianapolis. John is the father of 9 children and recently celebrated his 35th wedding anniversary. Congratulations, John. And John is in the fencing company, as you heard. And I'm just thinking, I have to mention this. You know, we have a fence around the White House. We have a fence around the White House. And they want to build a new fence. And I figured, you know, I'm pretty good at construction. I figured, I don't know, maybe a million, maybe a million and a half. And this has been taking place over a long period of time, previous administrations. So I said, how much is the fence you're talking around the White House? Sir, the fence will cost approximately $50 million. I said, what? I kid you not. And we have thousands of things like that, thousands. We're going to get it all down. But we think of that, $50 million. Now, I assume it's a strong fence. Okay. So, John, do you think you could do it for slightly less than $50 million? I think you could take 49 off right now and would have... And it had plenty of profit, right? Right, John? It's crazy. It's crazy. Never understand it, but we're working on it. John says that a tax cut, like we're proposing, will make his business more competitive, allowing him to expand, hire more workers, and raise wages for his current employees. Right, John? Also with us is Aaron Williams, a father of two who works in the field of information technology. Where's Aaron? Hello, Aaron. Hi. It's a good field. Aaron has seen the disastrous effects of high and just literally high corporate tax rates right up close and personal as more and more high-tech jobs are shipped overseas. You've been watching it, Aaron, right? All over. Like millions of other Americans, Aaron wants to bring those jobs back to the United States. We're going to reduce the tax rate on American businesses so they can keep the jobs in America, Aaron, create jobs in America, compete for workers in America, and raise wages right here in America. You're going to be in a much different position, okay? Thank you. Tremendous incentives. We want more products proudly stamped with those four beautiful words, made in the USA, right? Made in the USA. Finally, our framework encourages American companies to bring back the trillions and trillions of dollars in wealth that's parked overseas. Our current tax system, trillions. And by the way, for years I've been hearing it's $2.5 trillion. So I've been hearing this for about 5 years, so I assume it's much more, right? But Democrats want to do it, and Republicans want to do it. For years, who doesn't want to do it? They want to bring the — but they can't do it because it's so restrictive and the taxes are so ridiculous, so they can't do it. So the money stays in other countries, and it's invested in other countries. We want to bring it back. But think of it. It's one of the few things Democrats want it and Republicans want it. So they both want it, and yet for years they haven't been able to do it. Now we're doing it. We're doing things. You know, it's one thing when we want a health care and they want a health care and there's a dispute, but here's something everybody wants and they can't do it. So you can tell you there's a broken system in D.C., but we're getting it fixed rather rapidly. You'll be seeing that over the next few months. Our current tax system makes us one of the few developed nations in the world to punish our companies when they bring wealth earned overseas back into our country. We're punishing them for bringing the money back in. As a result, corporations have parked many trillions of dollars in foreign countries, and many have incorporated abroad in order to avoid our punitive tax system altogether. And some companies actually leave our country because they have so much money overseas, so much, it's an incredible amount, that they move the company to get their money. We're going to let them bring the money back home. Our framework will stop punishing companies for keeping their headquarters in the United States. We're punishing companies under our codes for being in the United States. We will impose a one-time low tax on returning money that is already offshore so that it can be brought back home to America where it belongs and where it can be put to work and work and work. The framework I've just described represents a once-in-a-generation opportunity to reduce taxes, rebuild our economy, and restore America's competitive edge, finally. And I have to say, just before coming here, we released some of the details of the tax and the tax reform and the tax cuts, and it has really received tremendous, tremendous reviews. And if Senator Donnelly doesn't approve it, because, you know, he's on the other side, we will come here, we will campaign against him like you wouldn't believe. I think they're going to approve it. I think we'll have numerous Democrats come across because it's the right thing to do. These reforms will be a dramatic change from a failed tax system that encourages American businesses to ship jobs to foreign countries that have much lower tax rates. That's what we can't do. Our competitors have much lower tax rates, but no longer. My administration strongly rejects this offshoring model, and we have embraced the new model. It's called the American model. Under the American model, we are reducing burdens on our businesses as long as they do business in our country. That's what we want. We want them to do business in our country, not to leave our country like a number of firms from Indiana. Some made some great promises to me, but those promises are only being partially kept because they're incentivized to leave, but now they're going to be incentivized to stay. And if that doesn't work, then we'll get even tougher than that, okay? We want our companies to hire and grow in America and to raise wages for American workers and to help rebuild American cities and towns. That is how we will all succeed together and grow together as one team, one people, and one American family. We want it to happen here. Tax reform has not historically been a partisan issue, and it does not have to be a partisan issue today. I really believe we're going to have numerous Democrats come over and sign because it's the right thing to do. I believe that it's the right thing to do, and I know many of them, and they're telling me it is the right thing to do. President Reagan's tax cuts were passed with significant bipartisan majorities at a time when there was a Democrat majority in the House and a Democrat speaker, Tip O'Neill. Before that, Democrat President John F. Kennedy championed tax cuts that surged the economy and massively reduced unemployment. As President Kennedy very wisely said, the single most important fiscal weapon available to strengthen the national economy is the federal tax policy. The right kind of tax cut at the right time, this is the right time, is the most effective measure that this government could take to spur our economy forward. That was President Kennedy. My fellow Americans, this is the right tax cut, and this is the right time. Democrats and Republicans in Congress should come together, finally, to deliver this giant win for the American people and begin middle-class miracle. It's called a middle-class miracle once again. It's also called a miracle for our great companies. A miracle for the middle class, for the working person. I truly believe that many Democrats want to support our plan, and with enough encouragement from the American people, they will find the courage to do what is right for our great country. But they'll only do it if you, the American people, make your voices heard. Only if you tell Congress to give us a tax code that puts American jobs first. And that's what we're doing. History has proven time and time again that there is no power on earth more awesome than the will of the American people. That is why today I am asking all Americans, Republican, Democrat, Independent, to join with me and with each other to demand tax reform that will truly, truly, truly make America great again. Call your congressmen, call your senators, let them know you're watching. Let them know you're waiting. Tell them that today is the day for decision, that now is the time to heal this self-inflicted economic wound, and that with their action, the future will belong to all of us. If you demand it, the politicians will listen. They will answer, and they will act. And someday, many years from now, our children and our grandchildren will remember this moment in history as the time when ordinary Americans took control of their destiny and chose a future of American patriotism, prosperity, and pride. With your help and your voice, we will bring back our jobs, we will bring back our wealth, and for every citizen across this land, we will bring back our great American dreams. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. Thank you.
That was President Donald Trump speaking at the Farm Bureau building in Indianapolis, Indiana, outlining the framework that his administration is presenting for a sweeping overhaul of the federal tax code. Quote, we want tax reform that is pro-growth, pro-jobs, pro-worker, pro-family, and yes, tax reform that is pro-American, the president said. You're listening to 90.9 WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's get some quick analysis here on what we just heard. We're joined in the studio by Evan Horowitz, Boston Globe's Quick Study columnist. Hi there, Evan.
Hey, Meghna.
And Noah Berger, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center. Hello, Noah.
Hi, great to be here.
But first, let's go to Washington, where Gordon Gray has been listening on the line with us. He's director of fiscal policy at the American Action Forum. It's a center-right advocacy group, again, based in Washington. Gordon, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. So you heard what the president had to say. We've seen a glimpse of the framework, which was released a little earlier today. It definitely has guidelines, but of course the details have to be fleshed out in Congress. And I got to ask you about that because
sure.
I'm seeing Senator Bob Corker himself, Republican of Tennessee, said today, I hope that people will have the intestinal fortitude it's going to take to do it right. People say healthcare was hard. You have no idea. You have no idea how hard this is going to be. Is Senator Corker right when it comes to tax reform?
Absolutely. There's a reason we haven't seen a fundamental tax reform in over 30 years, and it's because tax reform is hard. Tax reform is incredibly difficult. There are so many competing interests in the tax reform debate that often, you know, challenge a comprehensive reform.
Well,
I would expect along the way that this thing, even if it gets to the finish line, will be declared dead several times along the way.
Oh, interesting. Because, I mean, again, the framework was presented today. We see,
sure.
You know, a reduction in the number of tax brackets, reduction in tax rates, significant reduction in corporate tax rate, the identification of wanting to eliminate several other deductions, preservation
right.
of things like the mortgage interest deduction,
right.
popular stuff. But there is conversation in this framework about reducing a lot of the loopholes that corporations currently
mm-hmm.
use. I mean, it seems as if there's room for lots of pushback from businesses and wealthy Americans.
There is. The way the sort of progression of tax reform goes is usually folks campaign on tax plans, and we've seen what that looks like. It's sort of all the ice cream, none of the vegetables, right? It's here's your rate. It's going to be so low, and it's going to be amazing. And then when they have to get to governing, then they have to say, well, how are we going to pay for this? What are we going to do? What reforms are we going to do that goes beyond just the good stuff, the stuff people want to hear? And that's where the rubber meets the road and is often where tax reform dies, essentially, because when folks discover sort of what ox is going to get gored, what special provision, then the lobbyists suit up and go to battle.
Yeah. So let me just ask you two more quick questions before I turn here back here to Evan and Noah. I mean, first of all, What's your take on the framework that the president presented today? Do you like it?
I am withholding judgment until I see more. There's things to like in here. There's things not to like in here, but mostly there's things to await. They have inched closer to indicating what sacred cows are going to be touched. Mentioning that they're going to go after the business interest deduction is that's a big fight that they'll have, and they're going to pick it, if only a little bit. Doubling the standard deduction and taking and hinting at going after some other itemized deductions really picks a fight with the realtors, because when people don't have the incentive to itemize anymore, like most folks, frankly, then they're not going to take the mortgage interest deduction, and the real estate industry doesn't like that. That's a big sacred cow for them. So this document moves a little further than a campaign plan. It picks a few more fights, but there's a lot more to be had in the future.
So one more question for you, Gordon, before I let you go here. I'm seeing that groups such as the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget is finding that, as you know, insofar as we know what the framework presents, that it would produce a something like a $5.8 trillion in the federal government would lose $5.8 trillion in revenue, but could recoup $3.6 trillion, leaving an overall $2.2 trillion loss in revenue for the federal government. So adding to the deficit here, I mean, so the same group of folks who would support tax cuts usually are opposed to increases in the deficit. So that's
You know, I would exercise the, or you know, would expect of others to exercise the same restraint in terms of judging a plan that's not fully fleshed out. It's, you know, and that's a risk that folks run when they just put out the good stuff, is that folks are going to come and say, well, this is how much it's going to cost. How is it going to be paid for? I understand that, but you know, I think before we should take an estimate of the cost too seriously. We should wait till we have a full plan and a full cost estimate from the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Tax. That's what the tax writing committees in Congress are going to contend with. That's where the real reform is going to happen.
Gordon Gray, Director of Fiscal Policy at the American Action Forum, a center-right advocacy group based in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Evan Horowitz and Noah Berger, let's get back down to what the impact might be here in Massachusetts. Interesting to hear someone like Gordon Gray, though, be a little lukewarm so far. I mean, the devil is in the details, and we have no details so far, right, Noah?
Yeah, there are very little details. And the issue that's been talked about a little bit about, where's the money going to come from? And I think that is an essential question for anybody to ask. If you're talking about a multi-trillion dollar tax cut with over a trillion clearly not paid for, you need to – everybody listening needs to say, if we're giving a tax break to corporations with their rate going from 35% to 20%, who's going to pay for that? And we actually do have some clues. It was interesting that the president began by talking about the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act and cut Medicaid again, because we know that that is one of the proposals. It's proposals that would eliminate health care for 20 million people. And a major part of that always has been part of our longer discussion about taxes. And if you're looking at how you're going to cut trillions of dollars over the long term, things that will shift costs onto state governments, which provide things like education and transportation, cutting people off health care, those are the paths that exist.
So on that point, Evan, it's interesting that, you know, we talked just briefly about the preservation of the mortgage interest deduction, but it seems as if something in the sights of tax reformers is the state income tax deduction, which could hit Massachusetts pretty hard.
State income and property taxes. Yeah. That is, taxpayers get, you know, if you pay to the state or to your city property taxes, state income taxes, you can deduct that from your federal taxes. And wealthier people are more likely to use that deduction because they're more likely to itemize. And Massachusetts is full of wealthier people. So we're one of the states where lots of people use that deduction. And if Congress gets rid of it, people in Massachusetts are going to be upset. Now, that doesn't really matter because we don't have any Republican representatives in Congress, and Republicans are pretty much going to write this bill on their own. But there are states with Republican representatives who are going to be hard hit by losing the state and local tax deduction, like New York, California. But as you said before, anything you try, any loophole you try to close has a constituency that's going to fight back and fight back hard.
Yeah, so the tax code is the way it is for multiple reasons. But I just want to ask both of you really briefly. It was very interesting that the president spoke in Indiana, and he began his speech talking about Indiana's success in recharging its economy when our current vice president, Mike Pence, was governor there, because in 2013 he signed into law the state's biggest tax cuts in their history, a $3.5 billion package. That slashed income taxes there. And they've done pretty well in Indiana. So is that not one of those state-level laboratories that show that tax reform could work?
I don't think it is. And in fact, the president said positive and negative things about what's happening in the Indiana economy. I think the interesting example are the two sort of major changes. Kansas, which is not too far from Indiana, enacted the biggest tax cuts in decades at the state level with the claim that it was going to revive their economy. In fact, their economy went into a tailspin. Their bond rating went down several times. And eventually, a Republican legislature repealed most of those tax cuts because they realized they clearly hadn't worked. California, on the other hand, created a higher tax for their highest income people, over 13%. And voters just restored that tax rate again in the recent statewide election. And the economy in California is one of the stronger economies. You see Silicon Valley booming. Yeah. So I think when you look at what's happening in the states, the message is it's things other than taxes. It's your ability to invest in things like education and infrastructure that can strengthen an economy.
So finally, Evan, I was really fascinated to hear the president mentioning Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan with the Reagan tax cuts, because I just looked this up, that when the first Reagan tax cut proposals came out, Speaker O'Neill then said, quote, "Reagan has no concern, no regard, no care for the little man in America." So they viciously fought over this. But the president got his vote on this anyway and got his tax cuts passed. Is this like perhaps a premonition of what might happen with this attempt at reform?
No. But I'll say something else, which is that this just struck me as classic Trump, which is talk like a populist to govern like a plutocrat. There is an economic agenda for middle-class people, but it doesn't start with eliminating the estate tax and the alternative minimum tax. It starts with raising the minimum wage or, on the right populist side, putting in protections for worker groups and tariffs. It just doesn't look like this.
Evan Horowitz, Quick Study columnist for the Boston Globe, thank you so much.
Thank you, Magna.
Noah Berger, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, thank you very
much.
Thank you. You've been listening to 90.9 WBUR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with coverage of President Donald Trump's outlining of his proposal to overhaul the federal tax code.